Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent Kling alongside Leighton Kling. Coming up, we'll talk about Lowe's having a surprising quarter in the home improvement space. We'll also talk about Best Buy having a surprising quarter, but in the other direction. And we'll discuss some macroeconomic trends that may affect grocers in the United States. Our show today is brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. If you ever wonder why the coffee made in coffee shops tastes better than what you make at home, check out Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com for the solution. Use promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. We begin today's show with the Container Store as they beat both our expectations and analysts' expectations. They've made strategic changes and they appear to be taking hold with the case goods retailer. Their fourth quarter results were released on Tuesday, and this is their fourth quarter fiscal 2016. At least in terms of number of year, they're operating kind of a year behind everyone else. The Container Store is headquartered in Coppell, Texas. They were founded back in 1978. They emphasize so much the employee happiness of their organization, charitable donations, charitable spending, and that's why a lot of people were criticizing their IPO, but shares of the company back at the time popped about 35%. Since then, the company has been up and down, but recently it's been more down than up, and that may have changed here with their fourth quarter financials.
Revenue for the period was up to $221 million, exceeding the consensus estimates of $213 million. Again, up 5.3% from last year, and last year's revenue was actually up 5.8%. So one could say that they've actually exceeded twice the revenue expectations. Same-store sales were down, but by the smallest of margins, negative 0.2%. In credit to the management, they cited a 0.6% benefit from the Easter shift. Typically, you'll see a lot of excuses if something turns negative and a lot of reasons why their same-store sales are declining, those types of things. Here, they're saying that same-store sales would have actually fallen further if not for the Easter shift. Profit was the headline-making topic for the Container Store. Net income was $8.4 million. Earnings per share for the company actually doubled during the period, coming in at 17 cents per share. Analysts were expecting just 9 cents per share. And profit was higher because of a number of reasons. You had started the story off saying that they've made a number of strategic changes, but there are a lot of things to be covering here with this story. And this is one of the reasons, again, why they made headlines was because of some of the things we'll be talking about here. But management personnel has changed around, and there are also some fresh faces for the company to help guide them in a new direction. Last year on May 9th, in fact, the company had announced that then CEO Kip Tindall would be stepping down and succeeded by then COO and President Melissa Reif. Since then, the company has been facing up and down headlines, but as you had said, mostly down, Trent. In addition to some smaller in-store changes, the company will be initiating a four-part, what they call optimization plan that includes sales initiatives, certain full-time position eliminations at the Container Store, and realignment at Alpha, which is their custom closet side of the business, and ongoing savings and efficiency efforts. So what does all this mean? Well, they said there's actually no priority given within this four-part plan. There's not one piece of it that is more important than the other. They all have to come together, and they all have to be effectively taken care of this year. And you can see some of the results already is with Alpha, again, their custom closet design center that we discussed in the latter half of last year. They've seen a lot of growth with that, so they're looking to be spending a little bit more capital in that area. Additional SKUs are going to be within that area. They want more design options for their customers, so that is one change. But along with Alpha, management is so far pleased with the company's current direction, and you could see this throughout the company's statement. We are pleased to have completed the fiscal 2016 with a strong fourth quarter performance that exceeded our expectations across all financial metrics. They cited the custom closets business as being a positive contribution to those same store sales that we mentioned, and they see that overall sales trends seem to be improving in other product categories as well. And we talk about SKU rationalization here, and what this means is that they're actually going to be reducing the amount of SKUs per location. Right now, they said they average around 11,000 SKUs per brick and mortar location. That is from their conference call. And when asked about a target number of SKUs, what they want to reduce that down to, a logical number of items within a particular store, they said there's actually no target number, but they will be looking closely at every single functional category throughout the rest of 2017. And changes as it relates to the job cuts, I had mentioned in that statement, the four-part optimization plan, they plan to eliminate some full-time positions. Management seems encouraged by the cuts that they have actually made during the first two quarters. They've actually slowly started to implement some of these cuts, and you see it beginning at around the first week of April. And they said the elimination of certain full-time positions at the company stores, not only them, but the corporate office and distribution center, will save the company around $7 million in expenses while costing just $2 million. But overall, if you really look at the plan in terms of the total effect that it's going to have on the company, they said that the changes, not only the ones that have already started, but they are going to continue with, are going to cost around $9 to $11 million, but they'll provide savings of around $12 to $15 million. So if you look at that cost differentiation, Trent, they're adding about 3 to 5 cents to the company's bottom line in terms of earnings per share. Our slight criticism, and again, you had done a great job at alluding to this, is that we really look at the Container Store as a company that has prided themselves on having great loyalty with their employees, a really good brand, and that they've had a lot of great PR exposure from all of the things they've done here in the recent past, in the recent several years. The company is making it no secret that their main source of quality differentiation is the hands-on service they provide at the store and with these custom products. You can't have a custom closet design center without great staffing that knows the process inside and out, because this is a very complex process, especially if they're looking to differentiate and be a little bit more hands-on than their best competitor. And honestly, if you look at cutting staff at these stores, it will not only hurt morale, but likely cause higher turnover in the long run. And you could be potentially affecting some of these better longtime employees that have assisted bringing these programs online. And the company has spent a lot of money to promote these as well. And let's not forget the company's employee-first culture. You can go on their website even right now on their investor relations page, and this is pretty much the headline of the company. And the company, again, has received some positive PR over the last several years, not only due to how they express their love for their employees, but the relatively high wages that come along with that and their generalized compensation methodology. And in fact, I watched a 2009 interview with Melissa Reif, and she had said their core competency was in fact customer service, and that it is vital to the success, the long-term success at the Container Store.
So what might they be doing to counteract some of their perhaps losses in terms of interacting with the customer brought about by this cutting in staffing? Well, management noted that they were taking kind of a test and learn approach to some of their different marketing and rewards tactics for consumers. But they did note that they're combining some of the digital insight that they're gaining from their free membership program labeled Popstar. And this program does what a lot of other membership programs do as far as giving customers a chance to see new product listings. There's surprise perks, birthday gifts, exclusive events, that type of thing. They don't really sell it too much on the website, but they do market it quite a bit within their brick and mortar stores. And so they're going to be using data that's generated by this rewards program to try and tap into that, which might be maybe cut a little bit thin by the store level cuts. Since this earnings call marked the 2-year anniversary of this particular rewards program, management said the data from longstanding members is being combed through right now at the corporate level to help them better understand macro and micro purchase behaviors. Both, they've grown to a record 4.8 million users. They count users as sign-ups, so not necessarily active users, but 4.8 million people have signed up. Overall, with pop stars and their heightened experience in search, they feel like they were more effectively spending their marketing dollars. By the more effective or heightened experience in search, they're showing up a little bit higher in most of the search results for things like containers, although no conversion rates for their website were given, and conversion rates, something we'll talk about a little bit later on with Best Buy. Also on the marketing front, they'll be testing an HGTV partnership this year. We've talked in past episodes about how the popularity of HGTV and the DIY network as a whole have driven some more customers onto places like Home Depot, like Lowe's, where they're doing a lot more themselves, and perhaps the Container Store can leverage this viewership into customers walking through the doors. Their new locations coming for fiscal 2017 are notable. With as much visibility as they have in mainstream media, it's easy to forget how few brick and mortar stores that they have, and they're talked about a lot on the investor front. In fact, despite the fact that they have under 100 total stores, they opened 7 total stores in fiscal 2016, none in the latest quarter, but they are planning at least 5 new stores in 2017, which will give them 91 in all. They're currently at 86 stores, and that is given that there are no store closures within the next fiscal year. Shares after this entire earnings release were up initially to $5.76 per share from $4.15 per share before the earnings releases, so they popped significantly up. Now they're back down a bit to $5.50 per share, which is actually near where they were about 52 weeks ago. They have a market cap of just $265 million, as one might expect for a retailer that only really has 86 locations. They do have a more realistic price-to-earnings ratio, though, as far as we are concerned. They had a very optimistic price-to-earnings ratio about a year ago. Now it's more in line with what you would expect from a retailer that's starting to come into maturity despite the lack of locations. Their price-to-earnings ratio currently sitting at 16.
We move on to fashion and women's apparel with Chico's as they reported their first quarter, and it did not go as expected, as the clothing retailer reported falling sales and profit. Shares fell over 12% at one point on Wednesday of this week after the release and subsequent conference call. Chico's, for those unfamiliar, since we have only covered them about once before, has 1,492 stores across 3 different banners, including Chico's, White House Black Market, which was acquired by them in 2003, and Soma, which was actually created by them in 2004, another brand extension there. All banners have private label women's apparel, accessories, and related products. Chico's has roots that date back to 1983 in Sanibel Island, Florida, and Chico's is actually the largest piece of the company. We mentioned the 3 banners. Well, Chico's has 700 locations in North America. Soma is actually the smallest banner that they have in terms of brick and mortar. But we look at the results, Trent. Results showed that revenue was the biggest area hit for the fashion retailer, as they reported a drop in revenue to $583.7 million for the quarter. But this is from $643 million this time last year, missing consensus estimates of $624.8 million. So analysts weren't saying that revenue was actually going to fall below $600 million. And this is not good for the company. And this is actually largely due, this is a function of same-store sales falling nearly 10%, 8.7% drop across all stores when combined. Analysts were looking for just a modest 2.2% same-store sales decline. They were up against relatively soft comps as well, Trent, as the company reported 4.2% declines during the fourth quarter of last year. And again, this is with all 3 banners. What is interesting is that net income was greater than a year ago on far less revenue, but still missed expectations. Net income rose to $33.6 million or 26 cents per share from $31.1 million or 23 cents per share the same period last year. Analysts were expecting 29 cents per share. And if you look at some of the details related to the revenue miss, what is worse is that their 2 largest banners, again, Chico's and White House Black Market, ended up taking the biggest hit. We look at the same-store sales for those banners in particular. Same-store sales fell at those banners 10 and 9.7% respectively. But then if you look at Soma, again, their smallest brand, Soma's same-store sales were up 0.2% or 20 basis points. And I feel as though management was actually surprised by this. But in regards to the profit miss, Trent, we dig a little deeper and we see that overall the company has some other initiatives going forward that seem to just not be panning out.
They have shuffled things around over the last few years. Gross margin was $237.4 million, or down to 40.7% of net sales, compared to the $262.3 million, or 40.8% of net sales last year. It really, what we have here is a double-edged sword. Selling, general, and administrative expenses were around $182.5 million, or 31.3% of net sales, compared to where it was at last year's first quarter, which is 32.4% of net sales. This decrease in selling, general, and administrative expenses primarily reflects savings in store-related expenses. So what they're doing is cutting back in money spent on the store level, on the brick-and-mortar level. Also, it reflects a lower marketing spend for the company and the benefit of other previously announced cost reduction initiatives. But we mentioned that it's a double-edged sword because the store is faced now with contracting sales and it must right-size the business by reducing certain expenditures, but by doing so, there will be even less marketing and in turn, even less store traffic. So it's kind of a circular pattern here. With less marketing comes less in-store traffic, and that brings about less sales, more need to build up on margins. And we see this happen a lot with struggling retailers. According to the conference call, they're looking to make additional cuts in other areas that they feel like can be modernized. They compared their marketing dollars with their peers, saying that they need to bring down dollars spent to around 4 to 5% of gross sales. Although I don't know that peer comparison is the correct thing in this circumstance, since again, they are essentially a struggling company or struggling to bring in store traffic a little bit. They are looking to more strategically market themselves, something the Container Store had referenced in their earnings call. They're looking at target marketing, better social media efforts as well, trying to get their brand out there. But right now, they're struggling with finding exactly what their customers want and honestly, where their customers are at. They admit, and freely so, that they're in the middle of this transitionary period. Chico's new president, Diane Ellis, started last November, and she recognized early on after she started that the brand had product issues. She began to make changes in the area of knit tops, sweaters, things like jackets and pants as well, to kind of bring them up to what their customers, or what they felt like their customers, were looking for. They're about to finalize a research assessment too that they say will help to better identify customer style preferences, and they've rolled out some other updated tops and have liked the response so far. They're looking at what they refer to as more polished basics. As it relates, though, to consumer research, we know how quick fashion can change. And just the fact that they're doing some sort of a larger research study, it's possible that by the time that they get this data, things might already be altering. Even though we talk about how current customers are inherently your most valuable, with fashion, there's something to be said with talking and engaging with those that have left your business, trying to reinvigorate your brand by convincing those that have left or gone away that your business is still applicable and your business can still be fashionable. Ultimately, your year-over-year growth and your same-store sales growth will only take place if you can lure more customers in, if you can increase traffic. It's fine if your current customers like the current product, but at the same time, your current customers are spending what they are spending, which is a number that Chico's doesn't really care for. So you've got to find a way to lure either past customers or maybe future customers who have never shopped at Chico's towards your store. You got to do something to increase your traffic numbers, because basket size in this circumstance is not increasing either.
I wanted to discuss inventories a little bit, and as it relates to the company's performance, inventories totaled $273.9 million compared to $268 million in the same period last year. And if we take a step back and look at what this means, the $5.9 million increase in inventories is primarily reflected from a $10.5 million increase in in-transit inventories, largely due to what the company said was a shift in shipping terms with a major vendor. And this relates to an article that I actually read recently that spoke about how JCPenney is being hurt by vendors demanding stricter terms. And this is probably what is happening here with Chico's. And we see that the relationships between vendors and merchants is somewhat cyclical, with a current shift that prefers distributors and manufacturers of products over merchants. Even though retailers like JCPenney and Chico's are profitable, Vendors can demand better terms as they are not as financially robust as present-day Walmart, for example. To see the effects of upfront payments instead of payments on the sale in-store for goods, we will look at the accounts payable inventory ratio, as accounts payable represents the cost needed for current inventory and is listed as a liability on the balance sheet, while inventory is listed as an asset. The higher the ratio, the less short-term liquidity for the company. And as an example, JCPenney is around 0.34 here, where it was previously 0.30 a year ago because of these on-demand vendor terms that they are currently having to experience. Currently, Chico's is actually better off than they were last year as far as inventory payables measures are concerned, with a 0.48% ratio versus a 0.53 last year. So with management's comments during the conference call, it may be plausible that there may be something more significant that has yet to come into effect that we might be able to address in the second and third quarter of the year because of these new vendor terms. Now we move on to Chico's overall store footprint. They have a large store base, but it really, as this story indicates, is hurting and largely struggling, so it's logical that they've had to close down some locations. They have 1,501 stores at the end of the fourth quarter. They've actually since closed 11 locations while just adding two. Five locations were Chico's, four were White House Black Market, and two were their Better Soma locations. For what it's worth, they are trying to return value to shareholders via other means because their growth is tapering. During the first quarter of fiscal 2017, under its $300 million share repurchase program that was actually announced in November of 2015, they repurchased just 0.7 million shares for around $9.5 million in total.
Speaking of shares, their ticker, CHS, has lost nearly $1 billion in market value in the last 6 months. However, spreading out the time horizon, we see that shares are only off a bit from the historical 52-week mark. They're trading currently around $9.84 per share, but was over $11 per share before the earnings report. Shares were around $11 this time last year. We move on to the final story for the first segment of this Retail Focus podcast, and we look towards Washington, D.C. Now, we're kind of an apolitical podcast, and we'll try to remain that way through this story, but there are goings on with the latest White House budget proposal that have had retail organizations speaking out or issuing statements. The White House's latest budget proposal is looking to potentially make cuts in the nation's food assistance programs, and some of these retail organizations are questioning what this may mean for long-term sales. To preface this entire story, this White House budget proposal that was in the news throughout the week is most likely nothing what the final budget will be once it's pushed through after Congress reviews it and debates it. But there are some potential adjustments that are thought to be so significant in potential that several research agencies and associations, as we've mentioned, have made official statements. The National Grocers Association is one of those, the Food Marketing Institute another, and Gordon Haskett Research Advisors have also made statements regarding the current budget proposal. Let's start with the groundwork and the basic facts of this program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP as we'll call it, and as it's mostly called in grocery stores, is largely considered the hunger safety net for Americans in poverty or out of work. At least that's what the program considers itself. Americans who make up to 130% of the current poverty level, which is a monthly income of $2,600 for a family of four, are eligible for food stamps, for example. That being said, 44 million people participated in the program in 2016. And overall usage has steadily but moderately decreased since the peak of the Great Recession nearly 10 years ago. About 85% of eligible parties sign up, which is the USDA's target participation rate. And this comes from their 124-page 2016 budget, not from another resource. The money is segmented for food purchases only, and retailers have to be registered and approved to take part in the program. They've worked over the years to create a system that works for all parties. Now, Leighton, why don't we give the details of the proposed changes to the program were this budget to pass as it is constructed?
Well, we must start by saying that some of the proposals have been prefaced with the assumption that there will be a continuing decline with people in need of this food assistance program. So less people needing SNAP benefits. You had mentioned since around 2009, the numbers have steadily decreased from those who actually need or participate in the program. And we did discuss that 4.4% unemployment rate last week on last week's Retail Focus and have talked about slightly increasing wages as well. We've talked about a very tight labor market in the restaurant and retail industries. And so you see even some larger retailers bumping up their minimum wages. And also throughout the country, you see states doing the same thing. And overall, you see the funding for SNAP would be reduced by about $193 million over the next 10 years, according to this budget proposal. The legislative proposal also has states covering 25% of the cost of the SNAP programs over the next 10 years. So sort of a moderate subsidy there to take the pressure off the federal government. The government would be enacting a fee also to take the budget pressure off in the next 10 years for retailers that subscribe or participate in the SNAP program. And this is the most interesting part. And Trent, we were trying to gloss over the story, but this is really what had made headlines, because for the retail industry to take on the burden of some of these fees by just participating in a federally funded program is a little bit bizarre, because this hadn't been done in the recent past. According to the estimates, roughly $2 billion would be brought in after charging retailers what they call the acceptance fee. In a note from Leslie G. Sarasin, president and CEO of Arlington, Virginia-based Food Marketing Institute, she said the president's proposed budget seems to estimate that the $2 billion in revenue to reduce expenditures on the SNAP program would be generated for the first time by imposing fees on retailers serving as the delivery mechanism for these benefits. She went on to note that the current budget proposal undermines the efforts of many over the past several years, those that have been talking with members of Congress to get all of the details ironed out so that retailers really don't have to have the burden. In fact, they're making it more available for more Americans by accepting the different program ideals. Greg Ferreira, the National Grocery Association's Senior Vice President of Government Relations and Public Affairs, had sort of the same sentiment. He said America's independent supermarket operators have long been partners with federal and state government entities in the SNAP food delivery system. Since the program's inception, grocers have worked collaboratively with the USDA, which houses the SNAP program, Congress, and industry partners to improve efficiency and effectiveness in the program. And Chuck Grom, lastly, an analyst with Gordon Haskett Research Advisors, said Monday that the proposal may reduce average benefits to recipients by more than 30% to $173 from the current benefit around $252 per month. Again, this is a large average. But if you look at this as well, not only are the retailers going to be potentially having to pay the acceptance fee from the federal government, they're also going to be receiving less income overall. Whereas right now, they're already receiving less income because there are less participants in the current SNAP program. So 30% less revenue and a close to $2 billion tax, if you will, for those retailers participating in the SNAP programs.
When we talk about analysts' reaction to this proposed change, some analysts have said that the hardest hit retailers would be maybe smaller discount stores, Dollar General, Family Dollar, the like, potentially smaller supermarkets as well, maybe like Save-A-Lot, Aldi, Little moving into the United States may be affected by this, but generally stores that are in struggling demographic areas, so say analysts. But according to the USDA, retail supercenters account for about 51.7% of redemption of this program as of 2016, while supermarkets are next with 30% of redemptions. You don't really see the Dollar Generals of the world in that mix. So it might be Walmart, whose top line revenue would potentially be hurt more by this regulation change. And again, all of this is speculative because it's going to look a little bit different by the time it passes. Places like Walmart and Kroger, most likely the biggest current beneficiaries simply due to the amount of traffic that they run in to their stores. Walmart and Kroger, number one and two in U.S. market share in terms of grocery sales. They're also the ones that are more likely, though, to afford a potential fee put into place by the government. But this would in turn raise grocery prices or simply hurt the bottom line of these companies that we're talking about, especially since we're in the midst of what some people are calling a price war in grocery retail that's cutting into margins, not only with Kroger, not only with Walmart, Walmart, but across the board. And because Albertsons, of course, is privately owned, we don't get to see how much that price war might be hurting them. But it's just another thing that's going to cut into margins at a time where food deflation is still occurring. And we haven't seen that food inflation kick in quite yet, like we're apt to see potentially in the fourth quarter of 2017 or the first quarter of 2018. We'll keep an eye on what ends up passing over the next few months because, as we said, things are prone to change, and so we'll keep an eye on it for listeners. The Retail Focus is brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. Do you ever wonder why the coffee you make at home never tastes as good as the coffee you buy at a coffee shop? Let me let you in on a little secret. Coffee shops spend thousands of dollars to make the perfect water for making coffee. And now for as little as 10 cents per cup, you can duplicate that magic at home.
Third Wave Water has a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes for coffee brewing magic. Recently at the U.S. Brewers Cup Championship, the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water.
You know, I've been on the road traveling a lot this week. I use Third Wave Water to brew my coffee in my hotel room. It tastes so much better than traditional hotel room coffee or even breakfast buffet coffee. That is certain. Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com and use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. That's thirdwavewater.com, promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. We kick off the second block of the Retail Focus with earnings from Best Buy as they surprise with both sales growth and same-store sales positive metrics in both online and brick-and-mortar segments. There were many that have argued over the last few years that the electronics and appliances retailer had much to worry about with Amazon lurking in the background. And some analysts recently have even used H.H. Gregg as a cautionary tale for Best Buy. But a refresh strategy and closures of other retailers in this space have left growth room for both Best Buy and BestBuy.com. Let's get to the results. This is for quarter one of fiscal year 2018, as Best Buy is kind of operating a year number ahead of everyone. On the other hand, the Container Store, who we mentioned earlier, is operating kind of a year behind everyone. Their GAAP diluted earnings per share came in at 60 cents. This vastly beat Zach's consensus estimates of 40 cents per share, beating it by a good 50%. Some news outlets focused on the fact that this earnings per share was actually down from last year's earnings per share number for quarter one of 69 cents. However, we should keep in mind that their earnings per share last year was boosted by their CRT settlement proceeds, which actually got folded into the earnings per share bottom line number. So their adjusted earnings per share, which in Best Buy's case isn't adjusted necessarily this year because it's the same as their GAAP EPS, last year, their adjusted EPS was lower, 43 cents, than their GAAP number. So you see the 60 cents, that's a rise in non-GAAP earnings per share of 17 cents over 1 year ago. But it's not just that. Their same-store sales also improved over last year, similarly beating analyst expectations with a 1.6% system-wide overall brick-and-mortar boost. 1.4% of that boost came in domestically, whereas international Best Buy brick-and-mortar stores saw 4% same-store sales growth over last year's first quarter. The main story coming from this earnings release, though, was their online sales boost. Up 22.5% were online top-line sales from last year's quarter one. Bottom-line margins for the company sat at 3.5%. This is up from 2.8% last year. So not only are they bringing in more money, but they're keeping more of that money, retaining more of that money as well. It's still lower than many standard retail operators. We were talking of Home Depot and Target with their bottom-line margins sitting at about 6 to 9% last week. So 3.5% is still a shade lower than them, but it shows that operationally, they're having a bit more success this year than last. Top-line revenue overall was $8.528 billion, up 1% from last year, $8.443 billion. This includes the top-line boost from last year from that settlement we talked about. So the lack of a proportional increase is attributable to the settlement, but also some store closures, as they did close 12 large format stores, and 40 Best Buy mobile stores, the latter largely in malls, during the course of this last quarter. And of course, that's going to hurt top line revenue. Even if the stores weren't performing all that well, they were still bringing in some money. So you see a little bit of damage done on top line revenue. It didn't increase as much as you would expect with those solid same store and online sales. But there are a lot of takeaways from this earnings call, and their CEO was rather pleased with the company's performance.
Hubert Joly, their chairman and CEO, said the results were reflective of strategic success. And we look at the strategy of Best Buy now, and we really want to question what exactly is their overarching strategy. And in some interviews I looked through over the past year, actually towards the fall and winter of 2016, Hubert Joly said that they are actually in the happiness business, not just the tech business, and their stores are meant to be more like candy stores for adults, with remodels underway, as well as many changes to their e-commerce platform and obviously some added ingredients to their omni-channel network. They wanted no commission sales staff and increased training of their staff in the stores so as to have local experts. These product experts are necessary with some of the newer tech products they are trying to push, as we will mention some of those later on. First, they wanted to delve further into those buy online, pick up in store options for their consumers, while also leveraging their store footprints as more of a showroom to lead to online sales. And we talk all the time about how younger consumers will go into a store to test a product, but then buy it online somewhere else as a measure of pricing comparisons. We all do it. However, this really isn't the case with Best Buy, as you're seeing that they're actually retaining a lot of their core customers. Their online conversion rates went up during the quarter, and traffic did as well. And this is a solid future sign if you take a step back and look at their future quarters, as a number of retailers have been having traffic success, but have been met with conversion rate stagnation. They want to be a major player in the mobile segment as well. They mentioned this is a very solid strength for them. Sales in their mobile division were strong, going up once again in the first quarter. They were offset a little bit by tablet sales going down, but we've seen this trend happening. Usually with tablets, people aren't trying to get the newer, better versions of the things they already have. Most families already have 3 to 4 tablets, at least the families that I know of. And so it's something that really isn't going to draw a lot of growth for the future. But phones, of course, are going to be big and forever big. They also spoke of home devices as it relates to the tech department. They want and see a future where there's a lot more connectivity in the home. Obviously, Amazon and Google are big into this space right now. They also saw strength in the gaming industry, and in the first quarter, their comps in gaming were actually up 0.7%, of course, helped by the Nintendo Switch, which we had talked about at length throughout the last couple of months as it relates to gaming retail. But this also indicates shifting consumer trends, as GameStop has struggled somewhat as of late. So you've got to wonder if perhaps they are taking market share from maybe the smaller brick and mortar companies in this category. And finally, they want to amp up their services portion of their business. Services comps were up 4.2 year over year. However, services made up only 5% of their overall revenue mix. Weirdly enough, computer service sales were up and tablet service sales were actually down. A little bit less hands-on due to tablet fixes and things of that nature. They really don't need to be addressed as much as your normal PC issues. But here again, we see them transitioning to a more hands-on retailer. They spoke of trying to service the customer wherever they are. And I think this is going to be a trend going forward for Best Buy.
One other thing with Best Buy is that the closing of H.H. Gregg stores may positively impact them going forward. It's too difficult to know now because we're so close to H.H. Gregg completely shutting down. And what's more is there's a limited number of H.H. Gregg locations, right around 200 in the United States, that are near Best Buy locations that may be able to impact Best Buy's top line revenue positively. And then the other question there is whether or not there's enough crossover with merchandise mix to actually help Best Buy. I think there is. There's a ton of crossover, especially when you consider, as Leighton mentioned, although they don't take appliances necessarily as seriously as they take other segments of their business, appliance sales did go up during the last quarter. One of the things to note when you're looking at how H.H. Gregg closures may impact Best Buy going forward is that this impact won't fully be realized until the third quarter of this fiscal year, or fiscal year 2018, because it, at least in the short term, the allure of closeout sales at H.H. Gregg may draw a few customers away from Best Buy. But the real impact will be seen 6, 9, 12 months from now when those consumers who are looking for appliances or any of those big ticket items have to go to Best Buy or JCPenney or potentially another retailer entirely. Also, something we haven't yet mentioned, the fact that JCPenney is entering the appliance fray increasingly could pose a challenge to that part of Best Buy's business. So it's a potential that whatever positive impact they could get from H.H. Gregg closures might be offset by the fact that JCPenney is adding some of these larger ticket items that Best Buy is seeing success with selling. They didn't address appliances at all in their release, but they did see appliance sales up 4.6% year over year against really solid comps of over 14.3% up in the prior year. Finally, the fact that they surpassed expectations in the first quarter led to Best Buy increasing their earnings per share estimate for the second quarter. They're expecting non-GAAP earnings per share in the range of 57 to 62 cents in the second quarter. And they also expect further stability in brick and mortar stores with same store sales of 1.5 to 2.5%. That's a same store sales increase of 1.5 to 2.5%. And as we've mentioned before this point on the podcast, really with the current economic trends, anywhere around 2% is pretty good for a retail business.
We move on to our last story for this edition of the Retail Focus podcast. Lowe's had an off quarter, which was surprising to many after Home Depot recently showed an ever-growing home improvement retail business. Like with Home Depot, this was for their first fiscal quarter. The report is covering the period ending May 5th and came out on Wednesday before the opening bell on Wall Street. The company missed analyst expectations on revenue, same-store sales, and profit. That is not to say the company is not performing well overall, though, given the strong housing market and rising discretionary incomes that we've been talking about. Higher employment numbers, tighter employment and labor market lead to these higher discretionary incomes where people can afford to have that home improvement project completed. We move on to the financial results and see that top line revenue in the quarter came in at $16.86 billion versus a $16.96 billion forecast by Thomson Reuters. Still, a rise in sales by 10.7%, so double-digit revenue increases there. Same-store sales came in at 1.9% on the positive side versus a forecast of just 2.9%. So you're saying that they missed the forecast there, but the fourth quarter of last year, the last quarter they reported, they saw comparable sales of 5.2%. And then in the third quarter of the last fiscal year, they saw same-store sales increasing 4.2%. So from a sequential basis, they are dropping a little bit, even though 2 to 3% same-store sales is viewed as healthy in the retail industry. It is important to compare these analyst expectations, however, with company expectations so we see a closer look into what management has guided for in the past and what has become reality. So if we take a step back, we look at Lowe's business outlook for the full year press release in fiscal 2016, this past year, and the stated company expectations. And we see that the company expected same-store sales to increase about 3.5%. You compare that with the 1.9% increase for the first quarter here, when you see that the company did miss their own expectations, but this overall was for the full year 2017. And so if you look at same-store sales as they are for Lowe's, a function of only the physical stores, they have a bit of room to make up. And this is also notable, their full year guidance, because they called for quarterly average sales increasing 5%. But this quarter, you see that they had a 10% revenue boost, meaning that online sales are taking a bigger percentage of overall growth. It is important to note that the company reiterated full-year guidance, though, meaning that the quarters 2 through 4 will need to be very strong for the company since they missed this quarter. Store average ticket increased 3.5%. Transactions in the brick-and-mortar stores were down 1.5%, which is a bit troubling for the retailer. Combined with online sales, though, average ticket increased 4%, but transactions increased 6.4%. This means that they obviously have lower foot traffic inside their brick and mortar stores, but that could just be transferring to their online marketplace. With these better direct-to-consumer sales, you would think that profit growth was better than revenue growth, and it was. And they reported a 27% increase in online sales, and obviously these online sales tend to be a little bit more profitable on the gross margin front. So excluding the loss on extinguishment of debt, which we really don't consider to be a negative impairment charge, adjusted diluted earnings per share increased a whopping 18.4% to $1.03 per share from adjusted diluted earnings per share last year at 87 cents for the first quarter. On May 3rd, which was just 2 days before the quarter's end, they officially announced the extinguishing of debt $1.3 billion off the principal and outstanding debt securities. They recognized $464 million of this extinguishment during this first quarter. Even with the adjustment, analysts were expecting 3 cents more per diluted share in earnings. Analysts were also probably expecting share buybacks for the period, but it looks as though the company is focused on reducing their interest expense from outstanding debt instead. And we think this is actually a smart decision. Trent, you and I had talked about this before airing, that the company's shares are trading relatively high anyway. They're at a very high price to earnings ratio. So perhaps this is a better usage of cash for the company. And we always like to see a highly profitable company with very good, solid margins decrease their debt leverage. And this is exactly what they're doing here.
You know, when you compare it to Home Depot, Lowe's may seem a little bit lackluster, especially with this last quarter's results, but we need to keep in mind that Lowe's still had pretty strong net margins. They had net margins or net income over total revenue in the quarter of 6.3% without the debt payoff. So when you include the debt payoff, which again is more something that Lowe's is doing to position themselves for future success, it comes out to 3.5% after the debt payments of $464 million. Now, Home Depot, if you compare it to them, they had a net margin of 8.4%. But the 6.3 to 8.4 differential is not as great as it would seem otherwise when you add the debt payment there. Lowe's has always operated pretty well on the margin front, especially when compared to the rest of the brick and mortar retail industry. It just so happens that Home Depot is enjoying really, really nice margins. And overall, Home Depot's been one step ahead in terms of expansion westward, one step ahead in terms of building out their store count, and one step ahead also in terms of expanding into Canada. An analyst from Credit Suisse said this basically, is that, and I quote, "From a stock perspective, the headline may not spark a lot of excitement as expectations had moved up into the print and the bar was set higher by Home Depot." This is Seth Sigman writing this in a note to clients, but he said that in their view, the story hasn't necessarily been quarter one, but easier sales and comparisons starting in quarter two. And he mentioned strong underlying trends with Lowe's as a whole. Now, as far as categorically for Lowe's, when you break it down, the drop in traffic was blamed on outdoor items, which is somewhat odd because they boasted about a strong seasonal business in this release, which of course includes the outdoor items. And analysts kind of question this as well. And more inconsistency than anything popping up from the seasonal business. 8 of their 11 merchandise categories were positive, but 3 were mentioned in particular as being overly positive. Appliances, which we mentioned earlier this show for Best Buy, they're seeing strength in appliances. In-store visualization tools seem to be helping Lowe's, and they mentioned as much in this release. Assortment and competitive pricing were also said to help. They mentioned that kitchen was positive, which can also be lumped into some of their large appliance pushes, so they're selling connected items to some of these large appliances. And then flooring. And flooring is something that we've talked about in terms of strength for a good while now. If it's not the tile shop, then it's Lumber Liquidators. If it's not Lumber Liquidators, it's one of these larger operators like a Home Depot or Lowe's. We even mentioned strength as far as it goes with True Value and flooring. Lumber Liquidator stock, by the way, at a two-year high on multiple analyst upgrades, so you can expect flooring to continue to potentially be a strong category across the retail space as people look to kind of revamp some of the older linoleum or carpeted floors that have been put in over the last 20 years. Appliances weren't the only categories, though, to see success with lower pricing, but generally DIY categories as a whole. We've spoken before about the strength in just about every DIY category on the backs of strong ratings from cable channels like HGTV. More and more people are taking on do-it-yourself projects, and it's a different circumstance now because typically during, say, a recession, people will take on do-it-yourself projects because they can't hire a professional to come in and do it. Now they're taking on do-it-yourself projects because they're looking for perhaps an easy upgrade, or they've got a little bit of expendable income to pour into some of their house upgrades. So you're seeing the DIY scheme kind of change a little bit, and it's remarkable because not only the DIY section at Lowe's is seeing strength, but also some of their contractor sales are seeing strength. So it's not only people are doing this job by themselves, but they're hiring other people to do it. And those other people sometimes are shopping at Lowe's or, in certain circumstances, Home Depot. Management said during the conference call that because their pricing investment is now more widespread with DIY, they've been marketing the lower priced items when advertising in a certain category. So they feel pricing pressure from the general retail industry, but particularly Home Depot. And that's why they're going out of their way to advertise some of these low prices. And you see this in Lowe's advertising when you have prices that maybe start at a certain number or begin at or as low as a certain number. And their chief customer officer, Mike McDermott, said as such. He said, "We've got to face all competitors when we're doing this, and part of it is managing to compete on price." Now, as far as regions of the country, 12 of their 14 regions were positive. The Northeast and the Midwest, which is right around St. Louis for Lowe's, is the most notable, according to Rick Damron, their COO. This is another positive side. Again, so many negative headlines regarding Lowe's, but the fact that 12 of their 14 regions were positive certainly suggests overall growth and those strong underlying numbers that the Credit Suisse analyst Seth Stigman wrote in that letter that we mentioned earlier. Now, part of this growth overall for Lowe's seems to be with the recently announced acquisition of Maintenance Supply Headquarters, also known as MSH. They're a distributor of MRO products, or maintenance, repair, and operating supplies products for the multifamily housing industry in the Southeast, South, and Southwest. And obviously, there's plenty of synergies to be gained from that, but it's something that doesn't get talked about a whole lot. And it's part of that relationship, not only with contractors, but with other organizations, wherever Lowe's can acquire and build synergies to help out some of their corporate clients, they'll do so. And that's one of their areas of focus for not only this year, but well into the future. What are some other areas of focus that they have this year?
So as we touch on some overarching areas of focus for the rest of the year, one of the main pieces of focus for management was omnichannel, which obviously leads to more in-store purchases. You bring customers in the store from those online purchases. Perhaps they'll buy an accessory item or two to boost those in-store purchases and the brick and mortar sales. And like Best Buy, they spoke of increased store training. And we always think this is a plus because honestly, they have been targeting do-it-yourselfers a bit more than contractors or professionals. And I think when you do this, you have to have people on the floor, your store staff, the people that are in the front line, so to speak, really know the products and know how to apply them for each individual project. And I think because they are aware of this, they have been spending more capital into this store training, getting those people turned into your local experts. They mentioned more effective communication in installation sales as well. They said they realized that they have been getting bigger, and as they become bigger, it's more important to have people assist people with the processes as they can be multifaceted. Here recently, I had purchased some windows from Lowe's and had them installed, and you really have to look at the process from the outside and see that it's fairly complex. And I had had at least a half dozen phone calls with Lowe's staff during the process. You have to schedule appointments, have to have an estimator come through, and you have to have the installer schedule their time as well. So It's a very complex process, and Lowe's realizes that there's not only a lot of money to be made in this category, this installation section of their business, but that it is a very complex business, and it's easy for the customers to get frustrated since it does take a little bit longer than just a standard transaction. And then lastly, the last part of their overarching areas of focus was the further debt reduction to improve their debt to EBITDA ratio. Again, probably a good idea in lieu of these share buybacks that some others were expecting. Speaking of those shares, they dropped about 5% to around $78 a share from high 82. And you see that they have rebounded a little bit to around $81 a share, so they haven't lost too much. Just 2 weeks ago, though, they achieved their all-time high of around $86 a share. The company's shares represent a price-to-earnings ratio of around 25, which is pretty pricey in the current U.S. retail industry, and a $67 billion market valuation. Again, lastly, to put it in perspective, not to mention their biggest competitor yet again, but Home Depot's valuation is around $187 billion as of recording this podcast.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of this week's Retail Focus podcast, and in this final segment, we usually take a look ahead at one story we'll be following or the next week or the next month. And Layton, you're appearing right back in the department store category.
Well, this is going to be about a story we talked about including but ended up deciding not to, as Sears reported their quarterly earnings, and it's been all around the retail media. Sears actually reported a GAAP profit due largely in part to the sale proceeds of Craftsman. This is interesting because Craftsman was a brand that was worth a lot of money, not only the name but obviously the products that they carry, but this is interesting in that this sale, a lot of it went to pension obligations, and investors seem to be excited about this one-time sale leading to a profit, but overall, you see that they had a 20% reduction in sales, indicating more closings later on, potentially this year, and double-digit same-store losses in both Kmart and Sears. So again, we can't really call this a successful earnings call for Sears because of just the contracting business. And we talk time and time again as it relates to Sears and that the cost cutting associated with a lot of the statements made by management isn't really cost cutting. It's just closing stores and reducing the size of your overall business. So you can't really say that they're creating a more efficient business environment overall. And there was little mentioned about improving the in-store experience. And this all stems from those falling traffic numbers. I think what analysts and investors really want to hear is how they're going to increase those traffic numbers, because you can't keep having double-digit same-store sales losses and expect us just to be okay with the fact that you're closing stores. You need to have a mechanism in place to bring customers back in. You have to create value for your core customers. And whether or not the media has been so negative and that it has affected traffic numbers, that's one thing. But I really think that if management were to visit their stores, that they would realize that they have problems that need to be addressed, and they can use some of these other proceeds. If they were to sell some other brands off or other assets, maybe they can do something to really create the value other than the membership program they've been trying to push for over a half decade.
Well, I'm looking forward to what could be possibly the biggest story in retail over the next week or 2 weeks, as Walmart's annual shareholders meeting is taking place. Their annual meeting of shareholders technically is Friday, June 2nd, but of course, it's basically a week-long event. There's music performances, and as we found out last year, there's a significant number of protests. But I'll be looking forward to see what storylines emerge. Will it be e-commerce? Will they hammer home the Jet.com acquisition? How much TV time? How much FaceTime will Mark Lohr get? And what are some initiatives they're doing in the brick and mortar space to try and keep their brick and mortar sales robust? We've talked so much about Walmart increasing buy online and pick up in store capabilities, but we forget that they're also the largest brick and mortar retailer in the country. So I'm looking towards maybe some trends that they're looking to hop on, or maybe some things they'll be looking to do differently to merchandise their products, to make their stores and continue to make their stores look attractive to customers who are still shopping at the physical location. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Remember that this episode was brought to you by Third Wave Water. Check them out, thirdwavewater.com. Use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. We'll be back next week with Food Focus, as I'll be live on location from Colorado. So we'll talk about some Colorado-themed food items while we're there. We'll also have another Retail Focus for you next week, where we'll be sure to discuss that Walmart shareholders meeting in full detail. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast or shoot us an email, retailpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.